Chapter 10. Challenges in Every Direction. Korea Today. North Korea under the grandson. In the second decade of the 21st century, South Korea was becoming a center of high-tech industry and pop culture, with customers and audiences throughout the globe. It was a rapidly changing society, experiencing the implications of a gender revolution and the challenges of an aging population. It had one of the most democratic, if contentious, political systems in Asia, and a globe-trotting, sophisticated citizenry open to new ideas and experiences while treasuring much of their cultural heritage. But this new, dynamic, prosperous Korea had to deal with the other Korea, with its impoverished and depressed population, its militarized government, and its unpredictable leadership prone to bouts of open hostility. What had happened to the peninsula was historically unique. One of the world's oldest, most ethnically homogeneous lands had in a couple of generations evolved into two radically different societies. Indeed, the boundary between them was not only the most fortified and dangerous in the world, it also marked the sharpest contrast in living standards, lifestyles, and political systems between two adjacent states anywhere. In North Korea, the regime was determined to keep itself in power at all costs, while the general population managed to somehow muddle through. Economically, it stagnated. Diplomatically, it grew more isolated. Despite being called the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, it was the least democratic country in the world, paying little heed to its people outside of a small group of elites. In fact, it wasn't even a republic, but a monarchy, now ruled by the third-generation head of the Kim dynasty, Kim Jong-un. The grandson of Kim Il-sung and the son of Kim Jong-il, Kim Jong-un was surrounded by people of his father's generation. Some outside observers even thought that he might become their puppet. But this assumption was mistaken. The young Kim showed a ruthlessness that took many by surprise. In late 2013, he had Chang Song-taek, his uncle-in-law, who was widely regarded as the second most powerful figure in the country, arrested. Jung's humiliating arrest at a party meeting where he was dragged away was shown dramatically on TV. A few days later, he was executed. It was the first public announcement of the purging and execution of a top-ranking official in half a century, and the first known execution of one so closely related to the Kim family. Rumor had it that Jung and other officials of the purge were executed by anti-aircraft guns, while other officials watched the bodies explode into tiny pieces. These pieces were then fed to dogs. That last detail was perhaps an imaginative flourish, but it did convey the mercilessness the new leader showed to anyone who posed a possible threat to his power. Young Kim removed many of his high military commanders. Most were not purged, but simply demoted or forced into retirement. Overall, the scale of the actual purges was small, but high profile, signaling that there could be no challenge to his authority. One possible threat was his half-brother Kim Jong-nam, who, as Kim Jong-il's eldest son, could have had a good claim on the succession. Kim Jong-nam, however, had discredited himself with his irresponsible behavior. He lived in exile in China, where he spent half his time in Macau. By all accounts, he was a fun-loving, apolitical man, fond of gambling and women, and was not considered a serious contender for power. Besides, he was living under Chinese protection. It came as a surprise then when Kim Jong-un had him assassinated. The older Kim was traveling outside of China, walking through the Kuala Lumpur airport, when two attractive Southeast Asian women, recruited by North Korean intelligence, approached him and shoved a handkerchief smeared with a deadly toxin in his face. He died within minutes. This brazen, bizarre act sent a clear message. No potential rival was safe, even one under Beijing's protection. Since he had been educated in Switzerland and had greater experience of the world than his father, it was widely expected that Kim Jong-un would be more open to change, more liberal-minded. This was not the case. There were a few cosmetic differences. For example, he was shown in the media with his wife, a popular singer who wore fashionable clothes, attending entertainments and laughing together, something that his father had never done. Also, unlike his reclusive father, he spoke in public and addressed the people of the DPRK directly on television. His outgoing personality resembled his grandfather's. His physical resemblance to his grandfather was so great that rumors in South Korea claimed he had had plastic surgery to enhance the similarities. In fact, Kim Jong-un made his grandfather, rather than his father, the reference point of his administration. He revived some of the old institutions. For example, in 2016, he held the first party congress since 1980. His father had never bothered to hold one. In form and content, the event was very much a throwback to the days of Kim Il-sung, even referring to a new five-year plan, which would be the first central plan since the early 1990s. Some institutions were given back their older names. At the Congress, Kim announced that the grim struggle of recent years was over, that the country would progress ahead economically and militarily. This twin goal of military and economic progress, which he dubbed Pyeongchin, was in fact a revival of his grandfather's equal emphasis policy. However, there was really no equal emphasis at all. Rather, the emphasis was on the military, not the economy. Kim was single-mindedly focused on developing the country as a nuclear state, conducting the nation's third nuclear weapons test on February 12, 2013, then another on January 6, 2016, and a larger one on September 9, 2016. The sixth nuclear test on September 3, 2017, was far larger than previous ones, causing earth tremors in adjacent regions in China and Russia. North Korea claimed, plausibly, that it was a hydrogen bomb. And indeed, the test site of the bomb, Mount Mentep, in the northeast, was visibly transformed by the powerful detonation. He continued with his missile development, testing far more of them than his father had. On August 29th, and again on September 15th, 2017, he fired missiles over northern Japan, creating enormous alarm in that country. Attempts to develop a multi-stage intercontinental ballistic missile were unsuccessful at first, but then progress accelerated. On July 4, 2017, he provocatively launched a missile capable of reaching Alaska. A second successful test of a missile capable of reaching the continental U.S. took place 3 weeks later, on July 28. The next, in November, was capable of reaching Washington, D.C. The speed with which North Korea's weapons program progressed caught the U.S., South Korea, Japan, and the international community by surprise, and alarmed them greatly. Rather than easing international tensions, Kim Jong-un was bent on creating them. In the spring of 2013, he denounced the U.S. and South Korea during their annual joint military exercises. Of course, those exercises had been taking place since 1976, and every year Pyongyang claimed they were part of fervent preparations for a military invasion, rattling its sabers in response. But this time was different. The vitriol and threats issued by Pyongyang went beyond anything previously seen, with a declaration that it would turn Seoul into a sea of fire, and propaganda images showing DPRK missiles destroying Washington, D.C. North Korea declared the 2013 military armistice void and decreed all agreements with the ROK, including the joint declaration of denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula, to be terminated as well. Ominously, most channels of communication within the ROK were severed, and even the Kaesong Industrial Complex was closed. Yet there was no sign that the country was preparing for war. It was unclear what Kim was trying to accomplish. Was he trying to demonstrate to his military and people that this pampered princeling who had never served in the military was a tough and able commander? Was he trying to test the preparedness of his military? Or was he just trying to create a state of military tension to justify his focus on military spending and to rally the public behind his regime? Perhaps he was trying to achieve all these objectives. The United Nations passed a series of resolutions imposing economic sanctions on the DPRK. Most were targeted at the export of military goods and imports of materials that could be used for weapons programs and luxuries for the elite. With the missile launches and nuclear tests in 2017, the sanctions were expanded to target many of North Korea's basic exports. But even though China had voted for the sanctions, it enforced them selectively or minimally. Since nearly 90% of North Korea's trade was with China or passed through it, it was the one country that could make these sanctions effective. The Chinese, however, were unwilling to risk seeing the regime collapse. It feared chaos on its borders, a flood of refugees, loose nukes. Furthermore, if South Korea annexed the North, it would place a democratic society allied to the U.S. and Japan on China's border. China was also uncomfortable with the domestic repercussions of having an ally fall, and a communist one at that. Still, the Chinese were clearly unhappy with the regime. For the first 6 years of Kim Jong-un's rule, no Chinese leader or foreign minister visited Pyongyang, even as they managed to make it to Seoul. Nor did Kim Jong-un and his top lieutenants visit China. An exchange of intemperate remarks between Kim Jong-un and U.S. President Trump in the summer of 2017 gave the world jitters, since it made the threat of nuclear war seem real. And it wasn't just nuclear weapons and a missile delivery system that Pyongyang was working on. The regime was engaged in cyber warfare. Specially trained agents used servers abroad to carry out attacks. In late 2014, they hacked the computer systems of Sony Pictures Entertainment in retaliation for the movie The Interview, a rather crude comedy about the fictitious assassination of Kim Jong-un. The attack damaged the company and scared off movie theaters from showing the film, although it was aired online. This was the tip of the iceberg. North Korea repeatedly attempted to hack into South Korea's utilities, nuclear plants, and government agencies. It hacked into banks and stole funds and was suspected of letting loose internationally disruptive computer viruses. Then there was the country's chemical and biological weapons program, which included the use of VX, the internationally banned, very dangerous toxin that had been deployed to kill Kim Jong-nam. North Korea seemed unwilling to play by any international rules, becoming a true outlaw nation. Besides its concerns about an unlikely U.S. attack, North Korea faced real threats from its neighbors, China and South Korea. South Korea's very freedom and prosperity was an existential threat. If northern citizens realized just how much they had been deceived by their government, the impact would be devastating. It was therefore central to its security to keep the public misinformed about the South. This meant perpetuating the lie that South Koreans were living under foreign occupation, waiting for the North to liberate them. Refugees, to the extent that they believed any of this, were soon set straight when they encountered mainly contempt for the North, or even worse, disinterest among Southerners. China posed a very different existential threat. North Korea, for all its vaunted self-reliance, had become economically dependent on its giant neighbor, which had absorbed almost all the country's exports after the sanctions took effect. This gave it enormous leverage over North Korea. The greater long-term threat was that China would intervene in its affairs or even annex the country. Some in South Korea, seeing how important China was to the DPRK, began calling it the Fourth Province of Manchuria. By this, they meant that China was either preparing to economically or politically absorb the country into its huge northeast region, which was divided into three provinces. North Korea, under Kim Jong-un, carried out a few modest reforms, but mostly the regime simply let the semi-marketization of the economy continue. There was some economic growth, but it was modest and started from a low level. Much of it was directed at improving the lives of the elite, the bureaucrats, party officials, military and security officials, and key scientists and technicians needed for its weapons programs. These were the people that mattered to the regime, and for them, life did get better. There were more luxury vehicles, private restaurants and shops selling imported goods opened, and the state created amusement parks for the children, golf courses, and a ski resort for the adults. There was a visible housing mini-boom in the mid-2010s as luxury apartment buildings, at least luxury by North Korean standards, went up. There were just enough visible projects in the capital to demonstrate to foreigners, and perhaps their own people, that the country was making economic progress. The lives of the non-elite, however, improved only slightly. In 2018, the WHO estimated that 40% of the population suffered from malnutrition. Contrary to the expectations of some in the West, Kim Jong-un carried out no liberalization. In fact, security was actually tightened. A flourishing market in illegal Chinese cell phones, some of which could pick up signals from China, had provided a window to the outside world, as did the flourishing market in video cassettes and DVDs of South Korean dramas and movies. Kim's regime reduced those little windows to the outside world by developing its own cell phones that could not pick up Chinese signals, and by becoming more efficient at cracking down on smuggled foreign entertainment. There was less tolerance of illegal border crossings, and defection became more difficult. The world largely ignored the plight of ordinary North Koreans. There were no famous dissidents on the world stage, no Hollywood celebrities championed their cause, and isolation and language barriers made it difficult for their voices to be heard. A number of refugees, such as Shin Dong-hyuk, whose extraordinary life and escape from the Camp 14 political prison became the basis of an international bestseller, attracted the world's attention. Yet North Koreans in general were often viewed by the outside world as strange automatons, goose-stepping to the tune of the great leader, rather than a people suffering from a humanitarian crisis. Nonetheless, there were exceptions. In early 2014, the UN Human Rights Council issued a report by three leading international jurists that found the violations of human rights in North Korea so extreme as to constitute a crime against humanity. While this drew attention to the odious nature of the regime, it had no impact on its behavior or the lives of its people. Was North Korea at a dead end? It seemed to have no plan but to survive. There was no realistic vision of a path forward. Even in a good year, its economy grew only modestly and less than most of its neighbors. Once one of the most developed countries in Asia, it was now one of the poorest, and the gap grew yearly. By marshaling its meager resources, it was able to build up weapons of mass destruction, yet even its conventional armed forces were falling behind those of other countries. Its military vehicles were old and lacked enough fuel to do much training. Its air force was becoming a museum of ancient planes, and its soldiers were shorter, skinnier, and more poorly equipped than their counterparts in the South. Only its missiles, its nuclear, biological, and chemical weapons, and its cyber warfare units made it a significant threat. But this appeared sufficient for the regime to protect itself from invasion and perhaps keep itself in power. The end of miracles in South Korea. If North Korea only became more isolated in the second decade of the 21st century, South Korea became even more global, economically and culturally. However, the economic miracle was now over. Having leaped to middle-income status, it found reaching the top tier of high-income countries was a slower slog. Yet its capacity for change had not slowed. Its culture and society continued to evolve at a pace and in ways that were often unexpected. Politics revolved around swings from more conservative to more left-leaning governments. Lee Myung-bak, the conservative candidate who was elected president in 2007, gained office partly due to the unpopularity of his liberal predecessor, Roh Moo-hyun, and partly for his promise to resume the country's high economic growth rate. Lee's failure to achieve his unrealistic goals and his sometimes authoritarian style resulted in strong opposition to his policies, including candlelit demonstrations that became a more or less regular feature of South Korean life. His popularity plummeted. Lee was succeeded by his rival within the conservative Grand National Party, Park Geun-hye. In December 2012, she defeated the liberal opposition candidate Moon Jae-in, Roh Moo-hyun's former chief of staff. The divide was in large part generational. Pak won overwhelmingly among those over 50, but did poorly among younger voters. The eldest daughter of Pak Chun-hee, Pak Gune, was studying at a private school in Europe when her mother was shot and killed in an attempted assassination of her father in 1974. She then returned to Korea. During the next few years, she took on the role of First Lady and was an object of sympathy for much of the public, representing the human side of the austere Pak Chung-hee. Only 5 years into this role, her father was assassinated, and she withdrew from public life. She never married or had children, which was rather unusual for a Korean woman of her generation. In 1998, she entered politics and was elected to the National Assembly, becoming an active member in the Conservative Party. She lost the presidential nomination to Lee Myung-bak in 2007, successfully gaining it 5 years later. She was a polarizing figure. For many older Koreans, she triggered nostalgia for the days of her father, when the country was proudly lifting itself up by its bootstraps. But for others, she was an embarrassing reminder of that past, and of her father's political repression, his crude anti-communism, the exploitation of workers, and the human rights violations. Indeed, her candidacy was as much about dealing with the ROK's recent history as it was about specific issues. Interestingly, her gender was not controversial. This was not so much because Koreans had arrived at the point where gender no longer mattered, it was still a male-dominated society, but rather that progressives disliked her and dismissed her rise as being due to the fact that she was a surrogate for a former dictator, while her supporters backed her despite her sex. Pak's administration became a national embarrassment. She appeared to have trusted few people, but one she placed her faith in was Choi Soon-shi, the daughter of a shamanistic cult leader, Choi Tae-min. His was one of the many strange religious cults, some Christian, some hard to characterize, that arose during the unsettling years of the country's post-1945 upheavals and the dislocations caused by its rapid modernization. Choi Tae-min declared himself a Buddha at one point, then appropriated the trappings of Christianity. But he was best characterized as a charlatan who took advantage of young Pak Gun-hae by providing solace to her in the days after her mother's assassination. He then used his influence on her to enrich himself, a practice his daughter, Choi Soon-shi, continued. Although she held no official position and was not qualified by training or background to do so, Ms. Choi was President Pak's closest confidant, and even had access to classified documents. Choi then used her position to set up two foundations for culture and sports, which were really massive influence-peddling schemes. Prominent businessmen seeking access to the president donated millions of dollars to these foundations, which existed primarily to enrich Choi and her friends. Choi was unknown to the general public, but South Korean journalists became aware of her influence, and after details of her activities came out in the press, President Pak's approval rating began to plunge. While influence peddling was a common practice, the scale of the scheme and the unsavory nature of those involved caused national outrage. Massive, nightly, candlelit demonstrations appeared in Seoul that grew ever larger, becoming the biggest in the country's history. The public grew more outraged by Pak's poor handling of the crisis and by the revelation of more unsavory details, such as Choi's maneuvering to get her daughter into the prestigious Ewha Women's University. Tampering with the all-important college admissions process touched a raw nerve among Korean families. President Pak's approval rating fell into the single digits. In fact, in what may have been a record in the history of polling, it fell to 1% among younger voters. Televised hearings before the National Assembly revealed the scale of corruption involved. The old government Chaepol axis was revealed in its darkest light. At one point, the CEOs of the major Chaepol sat before the TV cameras looking like a criminal lineup. Each had given generous donations to Choi's foundations in return for political favors. Even the head of the mighty Samsung Chaepol found himself under investigation and was convicted of bribery. The National Assembly voted to impeach Pak, who remained defiant. A new election was held in early 2017, which Moon Jae-in won handily. The whole scandal revealed the pervasive corruption that still characterized business and politics. but it also showed how the country was changing. Its free and sometimes combative media, the growing public demand for transparency, its intolerance of corruption. Furthermore, it demonstrated the strength of its democratic institutions. The Republic of Samsung, the Chaebol, the economy, and political conflict. South Korea was so dominated by Chaebol that it became a matter of concern for those of all political leanings. After the financial crisis of 1997 to 98, the state had broken up the largest Chaebol into multiple companies, but in most cases the same families controlled them. Just a handful of giant conglomerates, such as Lotte, Ssangyong, Hyundai, and the largest, Samsung, controlled much of the economy. Each was a sort of universe in itself. For example, the huge Lotte group offered consumers everything they could possibly need. A South Korean could live in one of the many Lotte apartment buildings found everywhere throughout the country, finance their home through Lotte's financial services, and buy their insurance from Lotte. They could shop at a Lotte department store and buy groceries there, including Lotte food products. They could eat at one of the ubiquitous Lotteria chain restaurants and see a movie at a Lotte cinema. On the weekend, they could go to Lotte World, one of the world's largest entertainment parks, and when traveling, they could stay at one of the many Lotte hotels. Indeed, for some, life could be one large Lotte world. But the biggest of the Chaebol was Samsung. In the 2010s, it made up 17% of the entire economy. By any measure, it was huge. In 2016, Samsung Electronics was the world's second-largest information technology company by sales revenue, close behind Apple. Samsung Heavy Industries was the world's second-largest shipbuilder, Samsung Engineering the world's 13th-largest construction company, Samsung Life the 14th-largest insurance company. And there were other Samsung companies making cars and appliances and running amusement parks. So big and influential had it become that the country was sometimes called the Republic of Samsung. Since the Lee family still held control over the group, it could be regarded as the world's largest family enterprise, a title that might only be challenged by the Ibn Saud family, if the kingdom named after them is thought of as another family enterprise. In early 2017, the 49-year-old head of the Samsung group, Lee Cheong, from the third generation of the family, was convicted of bribery in the Park Geun-hye Choi Soon-sil scandal and sentenced to 5 years in prison. However, as extraordinary as it was that someone from such a powerful family could be sent away to prison, it had little effect on the power and wealth of the Chaebol and the families that ran them. Since members of the Chaebol families tended to marry each other, there was a fear that they could become, or had already become, a small social class of their own. If so, it was remarkably similar to the small intermarried group of elite aristocratic families that had dominated Korea from the Silla period to the end of the Joseon dynasty, and it faintly resembled the small intermarried ruling elite that had emerged in North Korea. These analogies should not be pushed too far. South Korea was a far more democratic society than either of these, with power more broadly shared. Still, the concentration of wealth among the Chaebol families made the general public uneasy. Calls for reining in the power of the Chaebol were strong, since it was felt by many that they were making it difficult for small startups to succeed. South Korea wanted its own Silicon Valley, with its many new creative firms. It also needed to move from manufacturing to a more knowledge-based and service-oriented economy. A symbol of this move was the brand new city of Songdo, a high-tech, eco-friendly, smart city located 40 miles, 64 kilometers, southwest of Seoul, near the Incheon International Airport. Mostly completed by 2018, it had an imposing skyline and some impressive facilities, but did not quite live up to its intended status as an international business hub. There was also an effort to develop centers away from Seoul, which had become a gigantic megalopolis inhabited by more than 20 million people, or 40% of the population. However, efforts to decentralize the country by moving its scientific and technological research facilities to the city of Taichung and constructing an entirely new central administrative city, Seichung City, had little impact on the continued concentration of people and economic activity in Seoul. Economic development sometimes clashed with the growing concern over environmental issues. The country had an impressive system of national parks for outdoor recreation, but there were few green spaces in the densely populated urban areas where the majority of the population resided. Some progress was made in cleaning up rivers and streams and preserving wetlands, much less so in dealing with air pollution. Seoul, in particular, was often covered by a sickly haze that made it difficult to even tell if the weather was sunny or cloudy. On one day in March of 2017, the air quality was rated the second worst in the world. Pollution was frequently blamed on China, which sent its notoriously dirty air over the peninsula. However, the government reported that only 30 to 50% of the pollution was external. The rest was self-generated, much of it from the country's coal-burning power plants. Baby bust, a society undergoing demographic change. Of the many changes in South Korean society, none loomed larger than the baby bust. In the 1960s and 70s, the state vigorously promoted family planning, and it was only too successful. By the 21st century, it was encouraging women to have more children. The decline in the birth rate was dramatic, and in the early 2000s it fell off the chart. With an average of 1.2 children per woman by late 2010, South Korea was tied with Singapore for the lowest birth rates in the world, lower even than Japan or Italy, with their rapidly aging, shrinking populations. Women married late, typically at 29, and had their first baby at 30. Many were not having children at all. As many as 15% of young women stated they did not want to get married, and bearing a child out of wedlock was still socially unacceptable and uncommon. Many women saw childbearing as a burden, a life of cooking, cleaning for their husbands, and caring for their child, one in which they no longer had any identity but as their husband's wife and their son's mother. In fact, traditionally, Korean women were seldom called by their given names once they had a son. Instead, they were known as their son's mother. For example, Kyung Hee became known as her son Cholsu's mother, or in Korean, Cholsu Eoma. Even in the 2010s, South Korea was one of the most male-dominated societies in the developed world. Only some Muslim nations and largely pre-industrial societies in Africa had a smaller percentage of women represented in political office, in managerial positions, as university presidents, and as CEOs. The very persistence of this paternalism was partly responsible for the lack of interest many women had in marriage, but it wasn't the only reason that women were having so few children. There was also the expense, especially of education. The educational arms race of getting one's child into the best schools kept driving up the cost and burden of schooling. Not only were Koreans having fewer babies, but as a result of improvements in healthcare, they were also living longer. By the 2010s, South Koreans were among the longest-lived people in the world, despite having higher-than-average rates of tobacco and alcohol consumption. The compulsory retirement age meant there were fewer older workers in the workforce, and the inadequate social welfare system meant that life was not always very comfortable for senior citizens. Most families living in comfortable but small condominium complexes did not want to share their limited space with their elderly parents, leaving them lonely and isolated. Many elderly people were forced to take part-time jobs to support their meager pensions. The biggest problem was how to support what would become one of the oldest populations in the world by mid-century when there were so few younger people. This was a problem shared by almost all developed countries, but South Korea's case looked to be more extreme than most. With the looming labor shortage and the prospect of a declining and aging society, many officials suggested immigration as an answer. The problem was that this ran counter to the kind of ethnic nationalism that characterized modern Korea. Although not as extreme as the blood-and-soil nationalists in the North, South Koreans still thought of themselves in racial terms. They took pride in being a pure-blooded nation. But it simply no longer was. Interracial and interethnic marriages were becoming common, in part due to the shortage of women. When the age-old preference for male children met the sonogram that could determine the sex of a fetus, there was a sharp rise in abortions, and soon far more boys were being born than girls. As is so often the case in South Korea, public attitudes quickly shifted again. Daughters became more valued, and the ratio of male and female babies returned to normal. But for the generation born in the 1980s, it was too late. Men turned to arranged marriages with women from other Asian countries such as Vietnam, the Philippines, Mongolia, and Uzbekistan. The number of biethnic children was growing so fast that, according to some estimates, they would make up a third of all children by the mid-2020s, a truly startling number in such a homogeneous country. There were also a growing number of immigrants from poorer Asian countries like Bangladesh, Nepal, the Philippines, China, Kyrgyzstan, and Mongolia, who mostly did the 3D jobs, dirty, difficult, and dangerous, that South Koreans increasingly did not want to do. The government did offer employers permits to bring in foreign workers, but this process was so cumbersome that many just brought them in on tourist visas and employed them illegally. The need for immigration resulted in efforts by government officials and academics to promote multiculturalism. Although the idea was intellectually accepted by many, it involved such a redefining of what it meant to be Korean that it was likely to be a hard transition to make. In any case, as foreigners were moving into Korea, Koreans were moving across the world. Emigration had been little more than a tiny trickle before the 1970s. Few had the money or means to do so, and the government made it difficult, believing that large population was necessary to compete with the North. In 1970, however, President Park, worried about overpopulation, decided to allow and even encourage emigration abroad. For most emigrants, America was the first choice. Those unable to get a U.S. visa often went to Canada, Argentina, Brazil, or Australia, and in smaller numbers to other countries. From the mid-1990s, emigration began falling because of growing prosperity and democratization, as well as the general improvement in living conditions. Yet if no longer a flood, a steady stream of South Koreans continued to depart for a different life abroad. They emigrated to spare their kids from the pressure cooker of the Korean education system, to try for a second chance if they had failed to get into a prestigious school, for the opportunity to work at a world-class university or research institute, to escape the obligations and expectations of Korean society, to be able to own a large home with a spacious yard, very difficult to do in crowded Korea, or simply to join family members who had already emigrated. Many were students who had found jobs in their host countries and never returned. By 2018, the South Korean government estimated 7 million Koreans and people of Korean descent were living overseas. This included the 2.5 million living in China, mostly clustered in southern Manchuria near the North Korean border, where they formed the Yongbyon Autonomous Region. About 900,000 lived in Japan, descendants of those who had voluntarily emigrated or had been shipped off there during colonial times. More than 2 million lived in the United States. There were 200,000 Koreans or people of Korean descent in Canada, 150,000 in Australia, 80,000 each in the Philippines and Vietnam, 50,000 in Brazil, where they replaced the Jewish community in Sao Paulo's garment industry, and smaller numbers elsewhere. Most Koreans prospered overseas. An exception was in Japan, where they faced unrelenting discrimination. But even there, many ran successful business enterprises, both legitimate and not so legitimate. Many Koreans overseas maintained strong family ties in their home country, visited often, and returned to retire or take jobs. All this extended South Korea's influence in the world and contributed to its growing cosmopolitanism. Gangnam Style, Pop Culture and the Korean Wave. Few developments in South Korea seemed more improbable than its emergence as a global center of pop culture. Korea had been on the periphery of international consciousness, a marginal player in the world stage. In the 1980s, its economic success had begun attracting some attention, but it was never considered a cool or hip place. Its entertainment was largely imitative of American, and more often Japanese, movies, comics, TV, popular music, and fashions. The South Korean government took pains to protect its small movie industry, severely restricting the number of foreign films imported each year, mostly Hollywood productions. Cinemas mainly showed local movies, which were much less popular. In fact, most movie companies depended on the profits they earned from gaining licenses to import films. Some Korean singers were very popular, often singing nostalgic songs for older folks, but young people listened to American pop. Television often consisted of American shows dubbed into Korean. Japanese popular culture was strictly prohibited. No movies, songs, books, TV shows, or manga. Then, when the government joined the World Trade Organization in the 1990s, it had to end these restrictions on foreign cultural imports as part of the agreement to open up its markets. Officials were particularly worried about Japan's slick entertainment industry overwhelming Korea's. Just as in the past, they had feared that opening trade with Korea's former colonial master would overwhelm it economically. What happened instead was almost the opposite. The flood of Japanese and other cultural imports contributed to a takeoff of Korea's own entertainment industry, and soon it was the Japanese who were complaining about the Korean cultural invasion. Some of this was due to individual artists who began to experiment and innovate in the freer society of Democratic Korea. State policies assisted. The Motion Picture Promotion Law of 1995 provided state subsidies to local filmmakers. And 4 years later, the National Assembly enacted a basic law for cultural promotion. Then the Chepol became involved. Chael Jedang, a corporate group associated with Samsung, which had until then been primarily known for food processing, formed the CJ Entertainment Company. Though they were initially modeled after Japanese J-pop groups, K-pop groups soon developed their own distinctive style, that was enormously popular, not just in Korea, but throughout Asia. They sang songs while dancing with almost robotic precision. Almost always young and cute, they winked at their adoring fans and flirted with them while performing constantly. Eventually, K-pop groups established fan bases worldwide. South Korean films also scored big hits, with increasingly slick domestic productions doing better than the now unrestricted flow of Hollywood films at the box office, and became popular throughout Asia. A few directors, such as Park Chan-wook and Kim Ki-duk, won critical acclaim for their artistic and creative films. But most Korean films were pure entertainment. Even more successful were Korean dramas that came to dominate television in almost every country along the Asian Pacific Rim. So many were watching them that the governments of China and Vietnam limited the number of hours local broadcasters could devote to Korean programs to protect their own industry. Even in spite of such efforts to restrict them, Korean dramas remained wildly popular. The well-produced shows presented beautiful people dealing with situations that other Asians could identify with. The nice homes and settings, not entirely unrealistic among the large, prosperous middle class of Seoul, presented a reachable modernity that Southeast Asians, Chinese, and others could aspire to. The shows were not only popular in Asia, but had large audiences in the Middle East, Latin America, and even Russia. In the early 2000s, the burst of Korean entertainment across Asia was known as the Korean Wave, or Hallyu in Korean. In 2012, South Korea had become second only to the U.S. as an exporter of entertainment. That milestone year was symbolically represented by the hit video Gangnam Style by Korean rapper Park Chae-sung, better known by his stage name Psy. By this time, Korea had become cool with young people abroad, especially in neighboring Asian countries, imitating Korean hairstyles, clothing, and other fashions. By 2019, the Korean Wave was becoming truly international, with the boy group BTS becoming a global sensation. Koreans were still importers and adopters of entertainment, such as Japanese karaoke, a Korean version of which, norebang, became a standard feature of Korean life. They were avid video gamers and the PC bangs, gaming rooms where young, mostly male gamers hung out, could be found in virtually every city neighborhood. Open 24/7, the PC bangs, contributed to a serious video game addiction problem, and eventually special computer-free clinics were established to treat young people who suffered from this illness. Some traditional cultural forms survived as well, such as the Chinese board game Paduk, also called by its Japanese name Go. Paduk had many avid fans, and South Koreans were often the world champions of the game. Taekwondo, a modern form of traditional martial arts, was popular, along with several other martial forms, and the ancient sport of archery still thrived. South Koreans usually dominated this low-profile Olympic event. Reunion? Reconciliation? Prospects for the future? In 2017, the new president, Moon Jae-in, was elected on a platform that emphasized domestic issues, the effort to end government-business collusion, anti-corruption, greater transparency, curbing the power of the chaebol, improving the inadequate social welfare safety net, narrowing the growing gap between rich and poor, and promoting equitably distributed economic growth, as well as tackling air pollution. He promised a major jobs creation program to deal with unemployment, a growing, if still modest, problem. Moon, a former student activist and human rights leader from Busan, had been Roh Moo-hyun's chief of staff and was mainly focused on creating greater social justice. His gestures, wearing more informal attire, keeping his modest home in an ordinary middle-class neighborhood, carrying his papers in a backpack, and being addressed informally, were all well-received. They were a clear break from tradition and symbolized a more democratic, open, equitable society. Although his agenda was mainly centered on domestic issues, he was almost immediately confronted with foreign policy crises. To the east, Xi Jinping was consolidating power to a degree not seen since Mao, while moving China along an authoritarian and aggressively nationalist path. On the other side of the Pacific, America's new president, Donald Trump, seemed less than fully committed to defending South Korea and threatened to end its most favored nation status, which would harm Korean exports. Nearer to home, Japanese Prime Minister Abe was pushing Japan in a more nationalist direction. The biggest problem was North Korea. At first, Moon, who was a supporter of the Sunshine Policy, had no choice but to take a hard line on North Korea, which issued bellicose threats, launched missiles, and tested a nuclear weapon. One reversal was on the issue of THAAD, Terminal High Altitude Area Defense Missiles. Aimed at shooting down incoming DPRK rockets, they infuriated Beijing, which saw them as a threat. When the Park Geun-hye government had asked the Americans to install them, the Chinese retaliated by banning Chinese travel agents from sending tours to the ROK, a blow to the Korean tourist industry. Moon had opposed the system's deployment, but now he supported it. Meanwhile, the Korean public, uncertain of the U.S. commitment to the defense of their country despite attempts by Trump administration officials to reaffirm it, and fearing nuclear blackmail by North Korea, began to support the development of defensive nuclear weapons. A late 2017 poll showed that 60% wanted South Korea to develop its own nuclear weapons, and 70% wanted the U.S. to redeploy tactical nuclear weapons in the ROK, a radical reversal of opinion. With its 24 nuclear reactors, South Korea had a large stockpile of nuclear material, enough to build over 4,000 bombs and the technical expertise to build them. But Moon reiterated his opposition to going nuclear. In 2018, Kim Jong-un took a more conciliatory stance, and Moon seized upon the opportunity, meeting Kim along the DMZ and helping to arrange a summit meeting between the North Korean leader and President Trump in Singapore. The issue of North Korea pointed to the fact that for all its achievements, South Korea still faced an intractable problem, the division of the country. Reunification had been the dream of almost all Koreans for two generations, but attitudes began to change after they witnessed the example of Germany's reunification in 1990. The general consensus was that Korea's unification would be similar. The more populous and much wealthier half of the country, the ROK, would absorb the less populated, poorer half. The enormous costs and difficulties involved in the reunification of Germany were truly sobering. West Germany had four times the population of East Germany, While South Korea was only twice as populous as North Korea, and the economic disparity was much greater. North Korea was far poorer and more isolated than East Germany, so the cost of bringing them up to a comparable standard of infrastructure and income would be far more challenging. Some estimates stated that the cost could exceed $3 trillion, a staggering amount even for prosperous South Korea. Furthermore, North Koreans were so isolated from the rest of the world, far more than the East Germans had been, that the task of integrating them into their society would be daunting. This was borne out by experiences with North Korean refugees who made it to the South. At the government-run Hanawon Institute, they had to be taught what a credit card was, how to use the internet, how to drive a car, how to open a bank account. Of course, such things can be learned, but even the refugees, who represented those who rejected the official culture and were enterprising enough to overcome the many obstacles and make it to the ROK, often had problems adjusting. Employers complained that they lacked initiative and were always waiting for orders. These complaints may have reflected prejudice toward North Koreans. Still, they suggested assimilation and integration would not be easy. By the 2010s, many South Koreans were no longer so eager for unification. Most hoped for it someday, but assumed it would be a long-term process, taking one or more generations. Younger people in particular had less interest in dealing with what they considered a strange, alien, and backward culture. The two Koreas in historical perspective. The two Koreas may have moved in radically different directions, yet they share the same historical heritage. Both Koreas emerged from the same Confucian traditions that still influence their societies. They share the same powerful sense of nationalism. Nationalism is a potent force everywhere, but Korea differs from many states in that this national identity is based on a long history of being a geographically, linguistically, ethnically distinct people living in a single political unit. That sense of a common Korean identity is so deeply rooted that even three generations of isolation and hostility are unlikely to undermine it. The two Koreas have been shaped by their common history. Both societies are characterized by a strong sense of hierarchy and patriarchy, despite espousing ideas of equality. Family and blood ties remain important to both. In North Korea, social status is determined primarily by family background, as had been the case in Korea from the earliest historical times. And the leadership itself was based on the Paektu bloodline of the Kim family. In the South, the family-based hierarchical structure is more fluid and subtle, but still can be seen. It is less obvious in politics than in other areas such as business. In fact, the ROK became unique in having a modern industrial economy dominated by some of the world's largest family enterprises. Both states carried on their long traditions of centralized bureaucratic rule. Until the system began to fray in the late 1990s, North Korea was arguably the most centralized society in the world. Everything from policy decisions to food distribution was decided from the capital. Even South Korea has had very little local autonomy. The very fact that two of five people live in greater metropolitan Seoul reflects the centralized nature of the state. Both Koreas used the powerful states they inherited from pre-modern and colonial times to carry out state-directed economic development. Koreans have always been fast learners, eager to acquire knowledge from abroad. In the past, they borrowed heavily from China, later from Japan, more recently from the West. In each case, they took what they regarded as the best from others and adapted it to their own society, Buddhism, Confucianism, Chinese literary and artistic styles, and then later Japanese and Western concepts of government, economics, and society. The two Koreas continued this tradition, with the North borrowing from Marxism, Leninism, Stalinism, and Maoism, along with some aspects of Japanese imperial culture, to create its own version of a progressive society. The South borrowed from the United States, pre-war and post-war Japan, and the industrial societies of Western Europe to create its own synthesis, a South Korean-style modern, sophisticated society. Yet for all their common heritage, the two Koreas evolved into very different societies. The division of Korea has been the nation's great modern tragedy. After more than seven decades, most Koreans still tend to think of themselves as one people. The division of their country is regarded as unnatural. Still, in the late 2010s, there is no obvious pathway to reunification, nor is it clear to just what extent the two Koreas have become not only two states, but two cultures. As of 2019, the prospects for Korean unification do not seem bright. But then, Korean history, especially in modern times, has been filled with unexpected turns. Who, before 1945, would have predicted the division of this ancient, culturally and ethnically homogeneous land into two such very different societies? It is unlikely that anyone in 1953 would have foreseen North Korea's evolution into a bizarre family cult state. South Korea's rise in just 60 years from one of the world's poorest to one of its wealthiest and most technologically advanced societies took almost all observers by surprise. Therefore, the only safe prediction is that whatever Korea's future course will be, it will certainly be shaped by its long historical tradition and most likely won't be boring. This concludes A Brief History of Korea by Michael J. Seth, narrated by Sean Renette. Copyright 2019 by Michael J. Seth. This unabridged audiobook is published by arrangement with Tuttle Publishing and was produced in the year 2019 by Tantor Media Incorporated, a division of Recorded Books, which holds the copyright thereto. Please visit tantor.com for more information on our growing library of unabridged audiobooks.